Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. We've all heard the saying, sticks and stones can break our bones, but words will never hurt me, right? Well, I'm sure most of us know that that's not really true. Words are indeed very powerful and can be very hurtful. And there is increasing concern about rising levels of hate speech, lack of civil conversation, and even cyberbullying. So today we will discuss why words matter and what nonviolent communication is and what it means. And joining us in studio this morning is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Welcome.
Good morning.
So let's start with what words or language actually is on a basic level. Sound vibrations, but more sophisticated.
Yeah, physically, absolutely, it's nothing but sound vibrations, sound waves. But it is uniquely human, certainly. You have to define it like that, although there is communication among animals, but in different forms. But it's uniquely human in that words can be combined and convey an infinite amount of information. And words, we think in words. In other words, we not only communicate with each other, but we communicate within ourselves in the form of words. Our thoughts are words. If we didn't have abilities in our brain, say, to decipher words, we couldn't think. We wouldn't. Our brains would be, I guess, blank. I don't know. But we wouldn't be able to affect our behavior and think out and think about the future, imagine the future. All of those things are uniquely human characteristics and traits and blessings. The important thing for our talk this morning is that it really has consequences.
We're going to talk a lot about that, yeah.
Yes, it has consequences between people, it has consequences in our mind. How we feel depends on what kind of words we're speaking to ourselves. In some ways, feelings are basic, but they also follow thought and the content of our thoughts. So without words, we really don't have much of a conscious life.
And really helping us to manifest ourselves in a very real way, even though our thoughts are invisible and words, when spoken, are in fact invisible.
That's right.
And joining us now in studio as well is psychologist Michael Abruzzese. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Sure, no worries.
A little foggy out there, slow ride in.
A little foggy and a lot of traffic, yeah.
Well, we are talking about kind of what language is very basically first, and we've talked about how they're sound vibrations, but in fact, when put together as they are, become very sophisticated things that help us realize who we are as people and then, of course, express ourselves to other people.
Yeah, and our brain works on models, so it's how we construct models in our head of reality and of people.
Right.
It's also a very important self-stimulatory aspect of people. It's why people hum to themselves, why they sing to themselves, sing in the shower, stuff like that. The vibrations, the frequencies are also very important to the individuals themselves.
Right.
Not just in communication.
Right. And I actually read in kind of prepping for this show that we talk more to ourselves really than we do to anyone else. And we don't even realize it because that's how we are. We're just constantly a self monologue. And of course we know, and we will talk about some of the negative impacts of this, but if you maybe have a negative dialogue going on in your head or monologue, that can have some side effects. Do we know how many words a human can know, or how many words are like in our language? I mean, is there a limit to that?
Well, the research that I've read years ago was somewhere around the words that they could know, not that they use, would be somewhere around 135,000 that they can draw from. But that doesn't mean they use them, you know, very frequently. There's only a small amount that people use frequently, and that's really one of the problems, because people tend to get into repetitive vocabulary, which you might call monologues, but they talk about things that are repeatedly, and they get into a negative, what I call a catastrophic cognitive cascade of the same negative language all the time, and that sort of keeps them trapped. We try to get people to change the way they think, and that helps them break out of the ruts that they're in. But of course, people tend to fall back into the things they've done for so long because we've reinforced our own language use for, you know, years, decades, lifetimes.
Is is there a number that psychologists have come up with in terms of somebody's average vocabulary, what it consists of?
I'm sure there are because we research lots of things, but I'm not aware
of that.
I imagine so.
And that's an interesting question. You'll have to Google it after.
It correlates with intelligence, I believe.
Vocabulary is, well, yes, it does. It correlates with intelligence on the IQ test that we have. But again, that's not the vocabulary that people use. That's mostly their just receptive language. So the higher receptive language you have, the higher your score would be on some kind of IQ test. And also, it makes you appear a lot smarter if you understand what people are saying. But people rarely use all the words they understand. They fall into the vocabulary in the context. So the vocabulary their family uses, their friends use, their boss uses. And, you know, you're very careful not to use words that other people don't understand because they don't value that. They criticize you for that and vilify you. So people have a very limited expressive vocabulary versus their receptive vocabulary.
Well, it reminds me of learning a foreign language in high school and getting more advanced. And my teacher said, you don't worry about if you're hearing a sentence or a paragraph spoken to you about understanding each and every word, just get the gist because there are going to be words that you don't get, but that's all right because you can put a context together fairly well. And that how do we perceive the spoken word, which we've been talking about, versus something like the written word? Is it different?
Well, in psychology, we consider verbal learning skills to be anything that has words in it, vocabulary, and sentence structure, and meaningful written or auditory context. So to a psychologist, there's not any difference. We group them together in verbal learning skills. But practically speaking, there's a big difference because people sometimes cannot express themselves verbally. And if they cannot express themselves verbally, sometimes they also cannot express themselves in a written form. Mm-hmm. But paradoxically, some people do better expressing themselves in a written form than they ever can verbally. Mm-hmm. So that would be probably diagnosed as some kind of verbal learning disability because there are differences between their predominant communication form, whichever type that happens to be, and then their weaker forms. So that really, you've hit upon something that's really important, especially in school, because kids quite often will have a subtle verbal or even a nonverbal learning disability, and it'll go undiagnosed. Nonverbal learning disabilities have gone diagnosed for decades before they were really emphasized back in the 1970s. And it's only been recently since we have the passage of laws for Chapter 766 in Massachusetts and the IDEA, the Americans with Disability Act, federally, that it's recognized and mandated that people get some treatment for their learning disabilities because at minimum, if a learning disability is not at least recognized and identified, then an individual has that. A person who has that will think extremely negative thoughts about themselves, and they'll fill in the blanks about what they think is going on. They'll think that they're stupid, they're crazy, they're weird, there's something like that. When in reality, their intelligence is fine. They just have an alternative learning style and a verbal learning disability or difficulty as opposed to a frank disability. And the front line of diagnosing that is usually schools because insurance companies won't pay for academic testing for a psychologist to do the testing. They rely on schools to do it, as schools, as we know, are overburdened. They don't have enough school psychologists. They can't possibly do all the testing that they're required to do.
Can you define verbal and nonverbal learning disabilities, how they're different?
Yep, good question. Different? Most of last study I read was, and I think the only study has been done, indicated that up to 93% of all our communication is nonverbal. So this would be how you stand, how you look at someone. You know, we're talking around the table now. I see some nodding heads. Mm-hmm. I see Dan waving his fist angrily at me.
No, I'm kidding about that.
Those are nonverbal kind of communication skills, and most of us communicate nonverbally. And one of the problems that kids have as they're growing up is they don't learn how to read nonverbal skills, and sometimes they never learn how to read those nonverbal skills. They can't tell when a mom or dad is angry with them, can't tell if the teacher's getting annoyed with them. They can't tell if the kid in the playground is teasing them or playing playful with them or is a bully. So nonverbal skills are any kind of skill that does not have anything to do with verbal or written communication. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to write about it, such as reading, writing, arithmetic, those are considered verbal skills, even though arithmetic you would consider to be a nonverbal skill. There's a lot of verbalization that goes into that. Right. But the ability to perform mathematics, the part-whole relationships, the perceptual organizational aspects of that, that is a nonverbal skill. So being able to understand mathematics, like a word problem, is a verbal skill, but being able to deduce the mathematics, especially a higher order math, is a nonverbal skill.
Mm-hmm.
So this was first popularized by, I believe it was Byron Rourke in the 1970s, and his book is still the seminal work out there, Nonverbal Learning Disability, and that's something I can recommend to people. But verbal disabilities are any kind of verbal communication or written communication. Nonverbal is everything else other than that.
Mm. So presumably, neurologically, different brain modules are involved.
Right.
To differentiate.
And as we know, the brain has multiple redundancies built in. So
right.
A neuropsychological evaluation, well, historically, always, they've been coming up what's called a double dissociation. You have to find those areas, plural, of the brain that are misfiring at the same time to account for where you want to localize a particular kind of problem mm-hmm. neurologically. Most neuropsych evaluations now don't do that. They've evolved to the point they just don't bother to do that. They just sort of describe what the problem is. But that's right. So if you have a real disability, you need multiple lacunae in your neurology.
Mm. Really, so, you know, it kind of demonstrates how complicated it is and how much of our brain is being used
right.
with these types of skills. And with words themselves, you know, we kind of touched upon how body language is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, in a radio, people listening on the other end can't see our faces. And so there's a lot of inferring that goes along. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot
That's
of
right.
nuance with just the words themselves that mm-hmm. we use, right?
That's right. Yeah, and there was a study that we came across that proved that. The study consisted of trying to determine emotions from just the spoken voice that somebody heard versus emotions from just the visible face
mm-hmm.
Versus emotions from the both together. And face wins out. In other words, people did much better accurately describing an emotion when they were able to see the facial cue as opposed to just the intonation of the voice. Vision is key in this communication.
Right, it's interesting. Mark mentioned that there was a study, you might remember this, Mark, back, I think it was back in the 80s, and it was about either political candidates or presidents or something like that,
mm-hmm.
where they had two sets of people who are impaired hearing or fully deaf, looking at a speech, you know, being given on a television or a video monitor, and people who could hear, and then people who could hear with the monitor sound turned down. And the mm-hmm. people who could not hear, just looking at the person's face, had a very different impression over whether the person was telling the truth or not
mm.
versus the people who are able to hear. And I forget what that research was or
wow.
what it involved, but
mm-hmm.
very clearly. So people who have the learning disability, you would say, of not being able to hear, actually can figure out what's going on perhaps better than people who are hearing
yeah.
in some
yeah.
circumstances.
Yeah.
They emphasize those
yes.
That information.
Right. They're
right.
focusing in on things
yeah.
that perhaps because we're processing facial cues
mm-hmm.
and also listening to words and processing those at the same time that
mm-hmm.
maybe you might make a facial expression that passes us by that we don't pick up on, that
right.
someone who's really just focused on that is going to say, wait
right.
a minute, that's telling me something here. Now, that is very fascinating.
You could actually say that perhaps verbal communication might be just a giant distraction technique.
Mm.
And we know that people who try to bury others in a wall of words,
oh, yeah,
at
sure.
some point you get the idea that, wait a minute, what's going on?
There's
something
That's
going
right.
on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 866-999-4626 or email us thepoint@capeandislands.org. We are talking about language and words and the power that they have over us and for us. We're going to take a quick break. And stay with us. We'll be back. And you're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. And my guests this morning are psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. And we're talking all about words. So, you know, there can be kind of a limit to language. We started to talk about this before the break and needing to see facial cues and body language and that kind of stuff. And, you know, we also often will hear someone say, oh, just words cannot express. So,
mm-hmm.
What role do words play in helping humans cope with and express emotion?
Key. First off, it should be said about speech that it's processed on two sides of the brain. And the content of the speech, the meaning of the words, is largely on the left side of the brain, whereas the intonation of the speech, how you hear it, how it's being said, is processed on the right side of the brain, which tends to be more emotional and creative. So that tells you that a speech is involved not just in information transferring, but emotional processing and emotional communication. So words and emotions are intertwined, basically. That's a rather basic aspect of our communication that needs to be pointed out.
Yeah, you think it's important to mention that quite often words are the source of misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And Catherine, you mentioned this earlier, talk about inferential reasoning or thinking.
Yeah.
Well, the in psychiatry, you know, Mark and I, our fields talk about projection as a defensive technique, a psychomedically involved, you know, technique, which means that I may say, gee whiz, Joey, you look, you know, acting really angry. Why are you so angry? And Joey's like, dude, I'm not angry at all. But in reality, it's my own anger that I'm taking and projecting onto someone else, or my own fear, anxiety, anything like that. And lay people have always had that. And to get an idea of kind of like the operationalization of psychology and psychiatry, you have to look at literature. You have to look at fiction writers going back 100 and 150 years. They talk about implication and inference, two great words we have. So if I'm implying something, that's coming from me. But if I'm implying something to Mark, he may not get that. He may infer something differently, which is all on the receiver's end.
That's right.
So
right.
Quite often there's a misunderstanding.
That's right.
So that's why someone will say, me, it's not me, it's you. No, it's not me, it's you.
That's right.
Perfectly legitimate kind of misunderstanding because of implication and inference. And
that's right.
A lot of people don't realize that.
So much more meaning behind a statement than just the actual words if you were to look up their dictionary definition and take them literally.
Yeah.
So much of what we say, there's so much more meaning behind it.
Absolutely. And it basically depends on your attitude and your frame of mind when you're hearing something.
Right. And it's something I call a semantic inequivalence. So I'm saying something and I'm using a word that I think is perfectly fine in perfectly context, and person I'm communicating with be like, what are you talking? I don't get. Or even worse, they actually do think they understand.
Yeah.
And they respond with language, but I think they're using a particular kind of word meaning, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like ships passing in the night, and neither party understands. And later down the road, you say, well, I thought we agreed that such and such, and no, we didn't agree on that at all. When in fact, the implication was that we did agree, but the inference was, you know, one part, that we did not. Very complicated.
So much of the communication is listening halfway to what somebody's saying to you, but thinking in your own head what you're going to come back with, rehearsing in your own head. We would do it on the show.
Yeah.
It's human nature, so that you tune out a little bit about what the person is trying to communicate to you.
Yeah, I remember doing an exercise in college to learn how to listen better, and they asked you to sit on your hands because it kind of made you aware of when you started to tune out to people and when you wanted to rebut or respond in any way. And it was really kind of eye-opening of how quickly in a conversation, even when we're engaged and we want to hear what that person has to say, we're already forming a, oh, yeah, I, or a, yeah, but, or something.
That's exactly right.
And
our attention can only hold so much.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard different numbers, but like the more recent reading, I've heard four items maybe. It can be comfortably held in attention. But when you get above that, you're missing.
Well, again, it depends on. I do have an information about that because of neuropsychological findings. In fact, it's typically it's between 5 and 7 items, but it really depends on the kind of items and whether they're connected to something else. An old psychologist back in the 1800s, Ebbinghaus, did. He was curious about this. He did the first research, and he was able to retain, remember, and repeat 100. Items, but they were numbers. They were discrete numbers. So, you know, 4, 2, 1. He was able to repeat a line of 100 numbers and it astonished everyone. But he was able to do that. But of course, your average person is not going to go to that kind of difficulty in learning. But typically, the average is between 5 and 7. If when you're a little kid, you know, 1 or 2 is about your limit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you have any kind of learning disability, it's even less than that, simply because your own anxiety over not knowing if you're being correct or not gets in your way, and it sort of trips you up a little bit more.
Absolutely.
So, learning disabilities anxiety, and that often follows, the dominoes fall into being depressed. So any child or adult who has an undiagnosed learning disability, they could be in a world of hurt, and they would not know how to communicate it because they would not know what's going on.
Right.
But as soon as it's diagnosed, the treatment is, you know, pretty quick and clean.
Mm. 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email at thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we have a call from Vanessa in Wellfleet. Thanks for calling in this morning.
Hi, great show. Just to bounce a little off of what you're saying, but kind of in the opposite direction, I'm curious about what happens to the brain, and also give you my own observations about a time I went on a week-long silent retreat where there was no speaking, no external words, and how interesting it was about how spending a week with people on a silent retreat led to a greater sense for me personally of connectedness to people, even though I was not interacting with them directly with any body language, verbal language, or touch of any kind. And then how different it was once we all got to talk to each other at the end, and the perceptions and the walls that went up, and sort of how the sensitivity of you know, being with those people and perception really shifted. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious to hear about what happens to your brain in silence and how important that is to practice.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the call.
Yes, that's very true. And I think we know from recent reports and studies that in times of war, military people talk about the fog of war, the chaos of war. One of the psychological techniques to disorient people are loud noises.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So when people of a certain age remember that maybe Manuel Noriega was trying to escape detection by the military, he took refuge in a church. And the military surrounded and just blared loud music all the time for days and days and days until he finally said, okay, you know, I'm coming up. So that really has a big influence on people. And I think anyone can tell, but we also have research to back this up. That's old research. The more congested we get, the noisier our environment is, the more stressed and anxious and crazed that people get. You see it in animals. You see it in humans as well. So unless you, and there's some people who do, thrive on a lot of noise and chaos, like folks who have ADHD typically, most people, they can't stand too much noise. It breaks their concentration.
Oh, I can't hear myself think.
Right, yeah. I can't hear myself think. It starts to sort of deteriorate their central nervous system, and pumps out a lot of cortisol. They get very stressed and anxious. So it takes, for those who are keeping score out there, cortisol takes, I think, about 8 hours for it to go away, Mark, once it gets pumped in the system.
If it does go away. You know.
Right. And so that's a real problem. So too much noise is definitely a problem. And if you want to disorient someone, you put a lot of noise in there, and you surprise them, you get a lot of noise.
But just the opposite, as Vanessa was saying, going on I'm sure it was a meditation retreat that she participated in, you take away the verbal communication, the verbal stimulation, and you get calm.
Yeah, peace and quiet.
Peace and quiet, But also there's a really inner sense of calmness.
Yeah.
Your own, I've done a retreat like that, and your own inner dialogue, mm-hmm. slows down and calms down.
Right.
And that's what meditation is for, really, is to have a break from constant communication. Because we're always, when we're interacting, we're always transferring information, but we're always managing our image and hoping that we're not going to be rejected or hit or struck, whatever, but thought of as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an inner dialogue all the time going on that. It gets exhausting.
Right.
So take away that need for communicating and just being, you get calm.
I think it's important to mention also that we really do a disservice, I think, to people here in America through our American education system, even though it's really a crown jewel among a lot of education systems in the entire world. We have an undue reliance on verbal communication at the expense of nonverbal communication.
Mm-hmm.
That really means that we're not teaching our kids to be aware of all the nonverbal learning that they undergo. And most of our learning, as I said before with our communication, most of our learning among and between people is nonverbal.
Yeah.
Right? And so
So where do screens come in?
I was just going to ask that question. Yes, that's a great segue. Is exactly, you know, we talk about having a device of some sort either in front of our face or in our hands so much more, and the good and the bad about that. But when we talk about language and being able to understand each other, what kind of impact is that having?
Well, it's a giant distraction technique, and people, you know, if the alternative is to distract myself from thinking about stuff that's important to me and thinking about stuff that's important to me, you know, 9 times out of 10, people can say, okay, I won't do that. I'm going to be distracted. I'm going to watch TV. I'm going to watch the movies. I'm going to watch. Now we have these handy dandy little screens with a bunch of, you know, unimportant factoids that all come around. Always, it's wonderful distraction techniques.
Right.
So really, these tools are very destructive to people if they are managed well, and you can manage them well. I mean, you know, Catherine, you're in the news business. You be on these things all the time. You get a lot of news on them, but your average kid is not looking for it like that. They're looking for something else.
Right.
So people who are really good gamers, well, that's a huge distraction technique for them. That it's kind of soothes and stimulates the central nervous system at the same time. It takes them away from things that are kind of important, like human interaction, figuring out what they want to do with their lives, how they're going to solve and whatever incipient problem they have to get their homework done or get home from school or the parents arguing, something like that. So screens really are a giant distraction technique that takes all the chaos of the world, all the distractions of the world, I mean, and sort of brings it right to us in our own earphones.
Yeah, we have a challenge of learning how to get the positive out of the screens and let some of the negative slide because it is negative, especially, let's say, with teenagers, where the whole task is to learn how to interact and be among peers and get along with others and communicate. You see teenagers sitting around and they're all looking at their phones.
And not each other.
They're not together. You know, there's cartoons of it about how they might send each other a text as opposed to speak. We evolved over millions of years to be social. And this is a little bit of a tangent from that evolutionary path.
When you think of, you talked about trying to escape it all with let's say gaming as your example, but then with teenagers, you know, you're so emotional at that time in your life, and so you can see reaching to social media to actually find an emotional connection. But then if you're taking away that interaction and the verbal, you know, the nonverbal cues that we were just saying are so important, you can see where the train might very quickly go off the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Human emotions are very messy. You know, human relationships are very messy, Ratha. And having the distance of a screen is much more soothing and much more manageable, even though you're dropping out approximately, you know, 90% of the kind of communication. It's a lot more easy to manage someone on the screen and to block them, cut them off, than to rather deal with them as a regular person or to deal with other people. So I think the new generation with the screens, they're trying to figure out exactly how to use this to their benefit. And I think they're actually creating a new kind of reality for themselves. And I don't want to come off as being too pessimistic about this. People have been complaining about the younger generation for millennia. Their writings back in the Roman Empire about this young generation is just essentially, you know, just falling apart. They'll never amount into anything. So people always have that complaint. It's simply a new means of communication. And we don't yet know how that is going to work out for better or for worse. It's always been a challenge for people to rise above the limitations of what society tells them should be limiting factors, whether you should behave this way or that way, how you might look at one thing or how you might think about something. And people who don't want to do, they don't want to invest the hard, it's really hard work in thinking. Thinking is really hard work. People who don't want to invest time in doing that, they wind up just being, as Mark and I talked about before, considered to be sheeple by other people. They wind up, you know, being part of the crowd, and other people tell them what to do, and they follow along mindlessly.
866-999-4626, or you can email us with a question or a comment at capeandislands.org. And not only, obviously, we're talking about kind of how teenagers shape their world through social media. We all do in some ways, if those of us who may use it. But, you know, why does it seem to allow people to be so negative? I mean, there's so much negative language, and of course, emotion is tied behind that. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's an easy way to express violence and aggression without being fully responsible for it. You're not, you just put it out there, and you hurt someone, but you're anonymous in a lot of these platforms. I think that's what we're seeing. And, geez, the Russians have learned this.
They were always good at it. You know, years ago in the Cold War, we talked about disinformation, you know, Russian dupes and who's a member of the Communist Party, and somebody was, but they didn't know that they were because they were tricked. All that was still true back then is still true now.
Oh, yeah.
Except using different language for it, but it's the same
thing. And they have different means of communication now with these Russian bots on the Internet. It really has an impact. There was a news story last night I remember seeing. They interviewed a Trump supporter who gathered a rally together. Mm-hmm. But the reason that they gathered it together was the Russians had made up a fake organization and say, oh, we're going to have a rally. Mm-hmm. Gather all your friends together. And they did. And the reporter confronted the woman who was involved in posting this and reposting it to get the people together, and she refused to believe it. Mm. She just refused to believe that the Russians were behind it. She didn't want to admit she was duped. Let's speak about words and the power of them and how you can influence behavior by manipulating information and communicating words they use words that stimulate emotion.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so
negative emotion, right? Largely.
Mm-hmm.
That's what propaganda does, right?
Yes.
It uses kind of common words, but that get right at the core of some deep-seated fears within any kind of given group.
Exactly. And so that determines the person's behavior.
It's interesting. Just to jump on what Mark said, I didn't read that story, but I understand that if a woman or anyone decides, no, I'm not going to, I don't believe that that was a fake person who said that. Yeah. Yet we tell our kids all the time, and perhaps this woman does too, if she's a mom, be careful who you talk to on the internet. They could be a predator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that there are sting operations people pretending to be young boys or girls to trap either predators or to be lured to a different city, you know, to become enslaved as a sex worker. So we warn our kids about a nameless, faceless people who may not be what they seem to be on the internet, yet maybe that same person would say, no, I refuse to believe that it was really a Russian or a Russian bot.
Right.
Well, it makes no difference. Why would you believe that there's a predator on the other side of the screen but not believe that there's a predator of a different sort on the screen? So there's a duality that people tend to cut off. And Mark and I have talked about this on previous shows. I think it's about self-preservation if they have to admit they're
self-image.
Wrong about something.
Right. That's right. Self-image. Yeah. Nobody wants to admit they've been duped.
Right.
That appears.
Well, especially if the message itself, you know, I was reading up on the similar story. I didn't read that particular one, but, you know, there's evidence that Russians came to the U.S. to learn about what our hot button issues were. What are the words, right? What are the kind of topics and issues that are getting emotional attention?
Right.
And so we're able to use that information to craft language, to use specifically chosen words to get a desired reaction.
That's right.
You know, and that's what predators or anybody really does. I mean, that's what propaganda is, but that's also what maybe a well-written speech might be to get you to act, right? We also saw that in a way with hearing from some of the teenagers in the Parkland shootings in Florida there who really were able to marshal some amazing language to kind of cut through some of what we call noise, right? You know, what we use in a figurative term.
Yeah, in a very raw emotional communication. There was an article written by a man who runs a business that tries to get clicks, increase clicks on his site. That's the whole game. Whenever he composes something that he's going to write, the first question he asks himself is, how is this going to make someone feel?
Mm-hmm.
Not what the communication is. How is it going to make someone feel? Which is a pretty good a mantra for a writer, I think, if they want to communicate effectively.
It is, but it could also, I think, as a journalist, be a little dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm just thinking about how to make you feel, maybe I'm going to be more willing to shade the truth, right? Or hide the truth, or color the truth, or even maybe omit words that aren't lying to you, right? But aren't also giving you maybe the full picture you need to make an informed decision about something.
Exactly.
Well, people who have that kind of, that's true what you say, people who have that kind of psychological bent really are just being dishonest. You know, they think they're being very clever because they always say, well, I didn't exactly say that. I let you infer that. Yes, but the fact that you're trying to mislead someone really identifies you as being a dishonest person. And I can say this on this show because your show will not get canceled. But advertisers do this for years.
Oh, sure.
Right?
So,
if we
had, they make their money. Yeah.
If we had advertisers on the show, they may threaten us about that. But the thing is, advertisers know that. If you want to get a manual on disinformation, just take a look about any advertising book in the last written in the last 100 years,
yeah,
and you'll see exactly how to do that kind of manipulation. Because every ad that you see, pick your favorite ad, pick your worst ad, it's all about creating anxiety in your viewer or listener, and then after creating the anxiety, telling them how they can satiate that anxiety. And Mark and I have talked about this before. Since most of us operate on a nonverbal, automatic thinking kind of level, it'll go right into the non-conscious, you know, thinking that we have. We're not even going to, you know, reasonably evaluate it to see what kind of BS it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they've been doing that for years.
Has to be some literacy there. 866-999-4626 or shoot us an email at thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have to take a break, but stay with us. We're going to continue to talk about the power of words when we come back. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd. And my guests today are psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. And we're talking about the power of words. And we have Donna on the phone calling in from P-Town. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. I was curious, as you talked about trying to influence people through words that convey feeling, and you mentioned the negative bent, but I also think that there's another piece to that. I think our society isn't necessarily attuned to having to deal, to converse on a feeling level, so that when that happens and it's from an honest place, it still has a negative connotation for people.
Mm.
And I'm curious as to what your guests think about that.
Well, thank you for your call, Donna. That is great. We wanted to get to this
exactly.
very topic, and that is how do we can kind of look at nonviolent communication and ways to be more positive.
Yeah,
so.
It was like she was reading our minds.
Yes.
So, a great call. There is a concept called nonviolent communication, which was developed by a psychologist in the 60s and more in the 70s and the 80s. Marshall Rosenberg is his name. He died a couple years ago. And he became very well known and became really a peacemaker and somebody who was sought out by industries, by nations to help people communicate when there's a conflict in, say, policy or what to do. He borrowed a lot from psychology, from, I think, Eastern philosophy to develop this concept that he labeled nonviolent communication. And there is a organization for it, and there's a website for it, which I would urge people to look into because it has some real meat to it. But basically, I'll try to explain it briefly, and please jump in and add or subtract. He said that human beings function according to their needs, and everybody, as much as we differ and conflict with each other, we still have the basic same needs. So that much of the communication that we do make, what we were talking about earlier about the Russians, et cetera, has to do with alienating others, pushing others away, really violent communication, rejecting others by making like moralistic judgments, demands, making comparisons among people. So we generally push people away. Think of Hillary Clinton when she let out that she thought that Trump supporters were a basket of deplorables.
Yeah.
Obviously, she was alienating everybody and probably regrets it. Or alienating a good portion. So that's the kind of communication that we sort of have as a default, where we get so angry because we have a certain need. One of the major needs is that of safety and security, so that we take positions that might be quite counter to, say, rational, more rational positions like the gun control conflict, to assure our safeties. So his way of communicating, say, with somebody from the right that is a gun advocate, he would first observe the person, how they're behaving, and address their feeling that they're expressing, one of anger and attack, because they feel the liberals are out to take away their guns and the government's going to make them impotent, and address that feeling in a real honest way, you know, eyeball to eyeball, without judgment, without judgment at this point. And it's hard to do. But the challenge is without judgment and address the need that it expresses. They're expressing a need for safety, for security. Just like myself, say, who is a gun, I consider myself a gun control or gun safety advocate, I feel unsafe too. I feel unsafe because there's so many guns around. But they feel unsafe because they need to have a gun because there are so many guns around. It's a circular thing. But we're basically dealing with the same human need. And we communicate. What we disagree on is the strategy of how to get safe. There's the problem. And that's what he communicated, or that's what he emphasized, that the conflict comes from not what we need, or not necessarily how we feel, but we differ on the, we conflict about the strategy of getting to where we want to. But if we can have a conversation where we discuss and empathically connect around the basic need that we all have, then doors are opened.
It clears the air a little bit.
Yeah, it clears the air, and you actually have a connection. You have somebody on your side to deal with a problem.
Well, it's reminding us, I think, that compassion is a big piece of this.
Absolutely.
And it's reminding us, as you said, so often we can feel alienated, or there's language around us that makes us feel alienated, and we have to remember, wait a minute, we're all humans.
Yep.
And if we approach it that way, it might take some of the sting out of something.
Right,
yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think this is a good concept for parents to have in terms of communicating with their kids, mm-hmm. and when there's conflict with their kids, and our teachers. And there is research where it's been applied and learned in prison settings, and it's decreased violence in those settings. So there's something to be said for it. So it's a framework, obviously, of a process to communicate that.
A strategy,
exactly. But it can be, I think, a pretty effective one.
I want to take a call from Lee from East. I'm sorry. I guess we've lost Lee from East Ham. Thanks for calling. If you want to try back, please do. Well, and I, you know, in the line of compassion and maybe changing not only just the way we approach a discussion, but actually changing some of the words, maybe using more positive mm-hmm. words. I read that there can actually be some health benefits to that as well, right? I mean, do negative words actually? I mean, we know they say they hurt me. They hurt. That hurt. What you said just hurt. Mm-hmm. But is it causing some anything biologically, internally?
Well, yeah, it does. Like we talked before about the cortisol cascade,
right.
You know, any kind of, I'll use the term stress as a generic term to talk about anxiety, depression, PTSD. You know, we all feel kind of stress. And you can think about stress as being like, now they call it a binary system. It's either on or off. You can either create stress or you can reduce stress. And the idea of our, internally, we have our central nervous system, but then we all also have what's, we artificially divide it into a sympathetic nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system. You know, one is in charge of our non-conscious kind of functions, heartbeat and stuff like that, and the fight or the flight mechanism. And the other is in charge of turning it off and the relaxation response kind of stuff. So the language we use really is very important. And I talk a lot about in my sessions, for example, if you're in a boat on the, you know, Barnstable Harbor right here in Woods Hole, and you're in a little 13-foot Boston Whaler, you don't really need a compass to go from, you know, one side of the shore to the other if you're going right across the bay. But if you're in, for example, the steamship going from here to the Vineyard or Hyannis to Nantucket, and your compass is 1 degree off, you are not going to make your target. Mm-hmm. You maybe will still make the island. You won't wind up in France, but you're not going to make your target. And language is the same kind of thing. So if I tell myself, as I mentioned before about learning disabilities, if I tell myself I'm just stupid or I'm just crazy, I'm going to believe that.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, it becomes real.
Why would I lie to myself? I'm not lying to myself when, in fact, I am misleading myself, but I don't realize it.
That's right.
Much like Mark's example of the woman who was duped by the Russian bot. She doesn't want to believe that.
Right.
So I am duping myself. I am, like, being very disrespectful and unhelpful to myself. And the hardest job that Mark and I have in cognitive behavioral therapy is getting people to change the language that they use for themselves so they get much closer to the target that they want to be on. And when Mark talks about nonviolent communication, it's helping people to focus on problem solving of what the real issue is, not what I think the issue is, not what someone told me the issue is, not what I am parroting about someone else's belief of the issue, but really getting down is the issue. And that takes thinking. Mm-hmm. And people don't really enjoy thinking very much. It's hard to do, and no one really teaches people how to do it.
Yeah, and you also want to develop self-compassion, non-judgmental compassion for yourself. That's what it's rooted in, because the suffering comes from the kind of negative ideas that you get wound up in, and it's unnecessary.
Right. Well, I always say in my session that suffering is like a gift we give to ourselves, and I'm being sarcastic. Suffering we do to ourselves. If I'm in pain, pain can be objective, but if I make myself feel bad over the pain, if I have the flu or cold and I'm suffering over that, I am making myself suffer. Cold doesn't make me suffer; it just makes me physiologically have the sensations that I have. But we all know people who have a cold or flu, and they're in pretty good shape. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still walking, talking. You know, they're being the best kind of themselves that they can be. We have other people, this is mostly men I think of, as soon as they get the little kind of sickness or flu, they're dying. They're on the sofa. They can't move.
Man flu.
That's right. So exactly. So suffering, like Mark says, is something that we do to ourselves that's all psychologically related, almost solely reduced to the language that we use inside our heads, and we call these automatic thoughts because they happen so quickly and so consistently that we don't even realize we're thinking them.
That's right.
And of course, our community plays a big part in that, right?
Yep.
And there's a lot of thinking and research on how community plays a part in meaning, right? Mm-hmm. So the words that, you know, I imagine that maybe some of it might be your personality, or you might be disposed to it, but so much of it is, right? If you're on Twitter all the time, you know, in the fire hydrant of, you know, vitriol, is that going to make you start eventually to think negative thoughts, maybe even about yourself?
Sure. It all comes down to, Mark and I have a little bit of a different point of view with his training in mind, but it comes down to a behavioral reinforcement, you know, Pavlov's dogs kind of stuff. So our thoughts are trained and reinforced just like our behavior is. If I'm reinforced to smoke cigarettes, that's a simple reinforcement paradigm, or to, you know, obsessively wash my hands, I've been reinforced. And the same thing is if I have been reinforced to think of myself in a certain kind of way, incorrectly or correctly, I'm going to be thinking like that. And after a while, I'm not even going to realize I've reinforced myself to do it.
Absolutely.
And most reinforcement happens at the nonverbal level, in a nonverbal communication kind of way, and we're not aware of it.
That's right.
Is it easier to be negative, you think? Are we kind of, as humans, disposed to just be more negative? Because we talked about the nonviolent communication program and how we kind of have to actually go learn how to do it. Is that just because of our society, or are we predisposed?
No, we are basically predisposed toward negativity, and that's how we evolved to be on this planet and the top species.
Right.
Because more people survived by tuning into the negative than they did with tuning into the positive. Because if you tuned into just the positive, you're liable to be a lunch of some other
animal.
You
might miss the negative that could end your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
survival mechanism in a way.
It's a survival mechanism, and we tune in and emphasize the negative and are biased towards it. So there's a natural.
Right, but now I'd say it's an unhelpful survival mechanism, like our appendix.
Yeah.
Does, but not a lot of help.
Well, thankfully, we absolutely can learn how to harness more of the power of positive language, and there are more than just the nonviolent communication program out there for people to access if they want to start thinking a little differently and a little more positively. That is all the time we have. Thank you so much for this talk today and the power of words. That's psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you for joining us for this morning's edition of The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, filling in for Mindy Todd.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.